Senate Health and Human Services Committee today. And before we get started, I know we need to pick up where we left off. And the committee has been given a handout that does not have any identification on it from who it was delivered. And I just would like to have whoever distributed this to come forward and tell us who they are and what it is, and maybe for future reference when we have handouts, the committee would appreciate it if they would be identified with who distributed them and whether or not they represent a department or other things. But this has no identifying mark on it. So can anybody take ownership of this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that handout is from the Department of Human Services.
Can I ask you to bring your microphone close so that we can make sure that we're catching you on tape?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that handout is from the Department of Human Services, from the Chemical Health Division.
Okay. And before we begin, could you please identify yourself for the record, and we'll proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Maureen O'Connell, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner of the Chemical and Mental Health Division.
Thank you, Ms. O'Connell. Is this something you'd like to comment on before we take up the change pages in the budget again? Could you tell us a little bit about what we have in front of us?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am wondering how there were a number of questions raised yesterday, and in an attempt to answer those questions, one of the questions, that handout is a part of that answer. And so I'm wondering if you would like us to kind of go through the questions we heard yesterday, and when we get to the question that answers that is geared towards that question, we could refer to it at that time.
Ms. O'Connell, thank you. That would be helpful, and I appreciate that. So, yes.
Okay. Mr. Chair, just to refresh the committee members' minds, place we left off yesterday was on page 94, the recommendation to tighten the chemical dependency placement criteria. And one of the first questions that I just want to address, and then I'm going to turn it over to Bill, the director of the chemical division, to discuss some of the other questions. But a fundamental question that the committee was asking yesterday was, does MA pay for room and board? And the answer to that question is no, MA doesn't pay for the room and board portion of treatment, which has – so MA only pays for hospital level of care as a per diem. And so yesterday I think we might have confused the committee in our answers to that question. So for residential treatment, again, MA would pay if it is for a hospital level of care as a per diem, but not in other residential treatment facilities would MA pay for the room and board. Does anybody have any questions about that before we move on to your next question, which was geared towards what are we getting for our treatment results?
Thank you, Ms. Connell. I'm not seeing any questions at this point, so please continue.
Okay. So next I'll turn it over to the interim director of the Chemical Health Division, Bill Weiss.
Mr. Chair, my name is Bill Weiss. I'm with the Department of Human Services. And we wanted to go over some of the questions yesterday. What are we getting for treatment results? I want to say that remaining in treatment for an adequate period of time, as well as strategies to engage and keep individuals, is critical for treatment. Research indicates that most addicted individuals need at least 3 months in treatment to significantly reduce or stop the drug use, and the best outcome occur with longer durations of treatment, according to the National Institute of Drug Abuse. Treatment completion is the most consistent predictor of abstinence across treatment settings. For Minnesota, on 209, our treatment completion rate was 60%. In comparison, relapse rates for addiction range from 40 to 60%, which is comparable to other chronic illnesses according to the Journal of American Medical Association. In addition, for other improvements that we see, we've seen improvements in housing. We've seen improvements in absence of alcohol and drug use, in employment, self-help group participation, family support for recovery, and a decrease in arrests. Some statistics, for example, in calendar year 2009, absence for drug abuse at admission was 59%, and at discharge was 80%. An absence from alcohol use at admission was 49 and 82 as well. This information comes from our department's drug and alcohol abuse normative evaluation system, which is information collected upon admission and discharge, which provides performance information of individual providers and aggregate information as well. Because we have a wealth of information, if committee members have specific data, questions, or requests, we can provide a written response. Okay, so another question that came up is, what's the length of residential stay for residential and outpatient services? And I wanted to provide that statistic for calendar year 09. The average length of service for residential treatment completion is 55 days, and the average length of service for outpatient completion is 92 hours. So outpatient is in hours, and then residential is in days. Also, a question was asked about the room and board. We have information from our claims data that in state fiscal year 09, there were 11,387 placements of room and board, and the average placement was 30 days. The other question, two more questions that came to the attention. How will the admission rates be impacted for the folks in our proposal? These individuals will still get outpatient treatment. And I want to refer you to the document, Mr. Chair, that you have. This is a document we put together that looks at multiple admission treatment. And what we came up in a splash here is that for 1 year of treatment, of span of treatment, 99% of clients receive two or less treatments. And for a two-year span of treatment, 99% of clients receive three or less treatments. So this particular document you have gives you that information of the populations, the methodology, and then it has a chart that shows the cumulative effect for that for those numbers. The last question I wanted to answer was, what will be the impact on counties for the loss of room and board for the 1,895 individuals? Counties are not obligated to pay for room and board because individuals will not qualify under the assessment process for this level of care. So, Mr. Chair, those were the questions I believe the committee had and wanted to provide you with that information.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Weiss, then how does someone get to the outpatient treatment program if it's not available in their own community?
Mr.
I mean, if they're supposed to stay in the home and then go to treatment during the day, how do they get to the treatment if the treatment is, you know, 50 miles away, for example, which in many parts of our state would be the case?
Mr. Weiss. Or Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair, my name is Gene Anderson. I'm the Treatment Services Supervisor for the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division at Department of Human Services. What currently happens is some programs are providing transportation and other exemptions within the law, within the statute, allows for persons that are over 30 miles to be placed in a residential facility.
Will that change,
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Berglund.
So now I'm confused. I thought the criteria was being changed so people wouldn't be allowed to be in a residential placement.
That's correct, but that's what currently is occurring. In the future, these folks wouldn't be able to be placed in that residential facility.
So I'm talking,
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, just to be really clear, I'm asking questions about this proposal, not what is the current practice. So somebody that lives 50 miles away from an outpatient treatment program, how are they supposed to get to that outpatient treatment program on a daily basis?
Mr. Anderson?
I guess I'm not sure how that person would do that. I think that would be a matter of working with their referral agent in terms of whether there's transportation available. If they're an MA client, MA can pay for transportation to the treatment services.
Senator Berglund?
Mr. Chairman, then would our transportation budget go up as a result of transporting people who would no longer be eligible for residential treatment?
Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, yes, I believe that's a possibility of that.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Berglund.
Is that reflected somewhere in the budget?
Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, I don't believe it has been. Actually, that would be an MA cost to the county that the MA would cover.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
MA is part of our budget, so if that part of our budget is going up, we should have an idea of how much. So we can evaluate whether this is a net win financially, whether it will be a net win in terms of outcomes. I still remain to be convinced about that, but at least you could show me if it's going to be a net win financially.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen. Excuse me, Senator Berglund. We will we'll do some work on that and get back to the committee if we can about the numbers that we believe that would be impacted.
Mr. Weiss, before you continue, I wanted to ask a question about your sheet that you provided the committee. You've given a couple of charts that are, I think, trying to show how many people are participating in some treatment and perhaps the frequency with which individuals may repeat treatment. I'm not quite sure if I'm understanding exactly what you might want to explain that a little bit. You're saying the table one overestimates the extent to which people return to treatment. I think that would be helpful to explain that. But another question that I have that I'm curious to. One of the things that we discovered with the restructuring of the GAMC program, for example, is that of the people that were seeking medical care at hospitals, emergency rooms, that the large majority of the costs were being generated by a relatively small number of people. And I'm wondering if, given this distribution of treatment, is that also true in this case? Is it the case, for example, that people who have received four or more episodes of treatment, are they driving a large percentage of the total cost of the program or not? Is that something that you can help us with as well?
Mr. Chair, I understand the question. Looking at the frequency of those folks, you're looking at over three, the four down. I don't have I believe we could probably find the source of who those folks are, but I don't have that in front of me. We could work with our evaluation. We'll try to find that for you. I'm not sure I can, but I will request that information for you.
Thank you.
As the chart, you can see that the first half of the page has episodes of treatment. And for folks that are in addiction, we calculate better looking at spans of treatment. Folks that may be getting an episode of inpatient, an episode of outpatient. And so the second chart better illustrates the patterns of folks getting treatment within a 30-day span. And so that's what you see in the second chart that represents those particular numbers. So it gives you both looking at episodes and looking at what a span is to illustrate that particular data.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Higgins?
Mr. Chair, aren't most treatment options 30 days. So how does that span thing work?
Mr. Weiss.
Senator Hankins, someone could certainly drop out of treatment. They could be in treatment for a week or so and decide that's not what they want to do. They could get back into treatment. That could have a relapse. So there's that span of that combination of different types of treatment. Certainly when you look at our average length of stay that I just provided, 55 days for residential, so that's the average. But there are folks that are in addiction treatment that necessarily don't fit those particular patterns, and that's best reflected in these spans of treatment.
Thank you.
Senator Newman.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Weiss, can you give me a working definition of a treatment episode? I mean, are we talking about like they go in for treatment one day, or is it each time, or what's the definition?
Mr. Weiss or Mr. Anderson?
Mr. Chair and Senator Newman, an episode in the top would be for an admission. And the table two would count if a person were to go into 2 weeks of residential care and then transfer to an outpatient within 30 days, within 2 days, that's what's considered a span. So that you're counting a person's actual treatment exposure from the time they start engaging in treatment to the time that they're not engaging in treatment any further, whether it's outpatient combination programs.
Thank you.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the numbers that I'm kind of looking for out of this, and I don't know who to direct this at, is not that information. I want to know if you have numbers that show people that successfully complete treatment, whether it be inpatient or outpatient, and then the numbers that once they've successfully completed that treatment, are they being readmitted at a later time? That's the number I'm looking for. How many successfully complete, and then how many come back into the programs? Do you have that data for me?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I do not have that. No, I do have the completion rate as a whole. I don't have the actual numbers of those that completed treatment. And your second question was more about when folks leave treatment?
It's about who successfully completes treatment and then gets readmitted. You know, they've started using again, and then they're readmitted. So those are the numbers I think that would be helpful to me. You know, how successful, I'm looking for the goals of these programs and how successful they are in treating these folks. And also, if I could ask just another question that just came to mind, do you have any data on programs that are successful, that have a better success rate than maybe others do?
Mr. Weiss.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we do have individual data that provides, I believe, completion rates. So, yes, we do have an aggregate of all. Well, we have aggregate, which is the 60% I provide today. But then we do have individual completion rates for the 300 and some programs as well.
Senator Berglund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do we have any information about how many of these individuals have been court-ordered into treatment?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, yes, we do. We do have that information as part of our DANE system, and we certainly can get that to you. Are you looking for percentage and or numbers?
Yes, Senator I Berglund. Am. Mr. Chairman, my concern here, Mr. Weiss, is that if people are not going to be able to get a residential placement and they've been ordered into treatment by the courts, that a high percentage of them will fail and end up in our jails, and that will be a county expense.
Senator Hoffman.
I just want to go back to my other question. So you don't have information, if I understood your answer, you don't have information that would tell me the people that successfully completed and if they're readmitted within a year's period of time. Is that information that you don't have? I didn't hear that in your answer.
Mr. Weiss?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hoffman, I don't know. I know we have the information of who completed, but I don't know is once they complete, do we have information that tells folks that have been readmitted? I don't know, but I certainly can check that out.
Thank you.
Senator Newman.
Mr. Chair, to all of the testifiers, I think
it's a
nervous
curse.
To all of the testifiers, what we're really trying to get at is whether or not the money that we are spending is being spent and we are accomplishing our goals. And we keep asking the question, but we never get the answer. Are the programs that are being offered, and the programs on which we are spending an enormous sum of money working? Are they successful? Should we reform this? Should we go in a different direction? And you don't have to necessarily answer the question today if you don't have the answer, but that's what we're really driving at, is are we spending our money well? Is it working? Or should we be thinking about doing something else?
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, I'd like to take a crack at that. The information we provided today gives a glimpse, I believe, of some of that. The national literature talks about completion rates being a huge success factor of folks who are going to continue to be absent. We do have that particular number here today. We also have these other measures that I provide that are part of our national outcome data. So we do have particular measures when you look at all these together that does have impact for folks that have addiction. So I think if we look at the whole, I think these measures do help contribute to success.
Senator Newman.
Yeah, and just to follow up, you know, Mr. Weiss, what you have to bear in mind is you have guys like me. We look at all of this information in these charts and the nomenclature, then we're not familiar with it. Consequently, I don't know what I'm looking at. So I think your job is to help me and put it into language that I will understand. And that's the breakdown for me, is that on all of the stuff in this book, we have got an acronyms and nomenclature that I am so unfamiliar with that when I listen to testifiers, it's going over my head. So I would just ask you to, you know, break it down in plain English for me so that I can understand. And I apologize if I'm dense, but it's difficult to get a handle on.
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, we'll certainly try to capture those pieces that would best illustrate success.
Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'm going to be asking some of the same questions, and just I'm wondering if these are the most critical measures. I mean, I think that it's true that most chemical dependency is not treated. And so if we just say once you make it out of a program, our measure is whether you come back into the program or not, we're missing people who may have relapsed into chemical dependency. They're not living safe and sober and clean out in the community, but they're not hitting this measurement. They might be in jail, like Senator Berglund was saying, and not reentering this. If our measure is only, you know, did they come back into our treatment programs, you know, for one thing, that measurement could be gamed. I mean, we could just not let people back into our treatment programs a second time and claim 100% success rate. If these are the only measures that we're looking at. So I mean, I'd really like to see some follow-up with people who have been through the treatment, completed it, and, you know, are they actually living clean and sober, successfully integrated into the community? Those are the measures that I'd like to see, and these are important measures, too, and I'm glad to have these, but I think that's going to help the members really understand better the success of the program. Overall, is just how are these people doing in the community settings, and where are they?
Mr. Weiss.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lurie, you're absolutely correct. A longitude study looking at folks that have left treatment is a great methodology to look at success. The part of that is it's very expensive to do, and I know back before I joined the division back in 99, Gene, there was a study that was produced that did have that kind of data. So we could certainly look at that, but that's, you know, 1999, and certainly your idea is great, but the expense to do that is enormous.
Senator Sharon.
I think this is a complicated issue when you just break it down into this one silo. So I know we've had hearings in our committees before that have looked at programs that have not required sobriety as a part of a homeless living situation, and measured the overall cost savings that occur by creating a healthful living environment and not, you know, for persons for whom treatment repetitiously has not been effective, to be able to offer alternative social interventions that have cost savings associated with them rather than just re-entry into a treatment program. And we should be looking more comprehensively, I think, than just at treatment programs. Another is homeless program that has wraparound services for people that the research is showing cost savings in these other areas, in the courts, in jails, and in emergency room visits. But they aren't necessarily these specific treatment programs. They're social service programs that require funding and wraparound services. So there's a cost to it. But the savings isn't going to necessarily show up in our budget. It's going to show up in somebody else's budget.
Mr. Weiss?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, you're absolutely right. You know, we have other initiatives within our division that look at prevention and other strategies. We have a project looking at trying to train physicians when people come into primary care so their doctors can help provide them with education, some screening, some brief intervention treatment. And we know that's another strategy. It doesn't show up in this, but you're right. There are other efforts across. And I know there's the city pilot project probably you're referring to that also have a different mechanism for sharing costs as well. So there are other efforts out there, and I'm glad you brought that up because we certainly have a great deal of prevention going on as well.
Members, I don't want to. I appreciate your willingness to help the committee understand, and I know we have more to cover, and we're don't want to get too bogged down in one thing. But I do want to give members a chance to ask questions and understand what is going on. And Senator Berglund may be able to help me with this as well. But we did have this morning in Finance Committee a brief presentation, too brief actually, about parts of the budget that have significant, the highest increases in spending, and the chemical dependency area was one of those. At least we didn't cover it in detail in Finance Committee, but I think that perhaps is driving some of the concern you hear the committee raising, is that we are spending a significant amount of money, chemical dependency, drug, alcohol treatment. And the real question, as Senator Newman is raising, I think others are raising, is are we spending these monies well? Are we really accomplishing the goals that we seek? Have we made progress? Are we making progress? Are we not making progress? I think there's great lack of understanding, maybe, is the way to put it. And I think there's some reluctance to say, well, let's just continue to do what we're doing, especially at a time when the revenues may not be sufficient to do everything that we'd like to do, and say, well, should we continue just to fund these things and do these things, or well, what is the best approach? So anything that you can provide us along the way here, and I'm not necessarily asking you to provide that right now today, but to help us understand this area of the budget more completely would be very helpful.
Certainly, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And if there aren't any other questions on this particular change or the handout that we have, I'd be happy to have you proceed.
Mr. Chair, then turning to the next budget page 95, this is the governor's proposal to increase the county's share of chemical dependency treatment costs. Currently, the county share of non-federal treatment cost is currently 16.14% for clients who access the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund and are not enrolled in medical assistance. This proposal would increase the county share to 22.95%. The result of this proposal would save over $9 million over the biennium.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, my understanding of the way this works is that rather than just having a straight across-the-board share, that when the counties enter kind of a donut hole period where they pay 100% of the treatment costs and that it affects different counties differently. So I'm wondering if this proposal is only going to affect those counties that are currently below the 22%. 22.95%, because there are some counties that are at a 50% or higher amount of paying for this treatment.
Ms. O'Connor.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, as I understand it, the donut hole changed last year, and that donut hole was converted to the current rate of 16.14%.
Okay, so
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Assistant Commissioner, this would affect every county exactly in the same way.
Yes. Yes.
Ms. O'Connell.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, yes.
Just Senator Newman and then Senator Newman.
Ms. O'Connell, is this $9.5 million that is being counted as a savings merely a shift, unfunded shift onto the budgets of the counties?
Ms. O'Connell.
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, we also we are also hopeful. Yes, the answer would be yes.
Thank
this
you.
Would be a shift, but there is a big but. We are expanding medical assistance coverage on March 1st to a significant number of new people, and we are hoping that this increase will be offset by more of the people being on medical assistance. Because, again, this is for clients who are not enrolled in medical assistance. We're doing the preliminary work on those numbers to see how the expansion of medical assistance will impact this budget page, but we don't have those final numbers.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
But, Ms. O'Connell, when I go home and I talk to my county commissioners, what they are going to say to me is, if I support this, you are creating yet another unfunded mandate on us, aren't they?
Ms. O'Connell.
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, again, we think that this will be significantly offset by the medical assistance expansion. But, yes, this is increasing the county share, potentially increasing the county share. And so we are in tough times. This is a difficult cut to put in place.
Sir Marty?
Mr. Chairman, yeah, I guess I was interested in the same thing. I think the medical assistance will be a big offset, but I was just curious because I just keep seeing this and the programs yesterday and so on, a whole lot of it shifting to the counties, and, well, they'll either cover it or they won't cover it, and a whole lot of these are things that need to be done. I was just curious if the department is wait till after medical assistance can be factored in, but is somebody tallying how much this is shifting to the counties between not just the chemical dependency but all the other things, because I don't know where the counties are going to get the money.
Ms. O'Connell.
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, we on this budget page, we will be getting back to you with estimates of the offset that the medical assistance expansion will have on this particular budget page. And again, I think that the governor's approach overall was to not cut local government aid in order for the counties to retain flexibility to address other cuts that are happening in other parts of the budget.
Mr. Chairman, I just a comment, and that is that the county aid, I mean, they've been getting the county aid, and we're dumping just looking through the first few pages of the book we've gone through, we're putting a whole lot of additional costs on, and I just want to express real concern about that, because I think somehow or another there are gaps that are growing, and I don't know how we're going to fill them.
Senator Nino, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Sorry. It looked important. I didn't want to interrupt. My understanding is that this shift, I won't call it an unfunded mandate, but an unfunded liability maybe, I don't know, but the shift to the county, you're hoping would be offset by the increased participation with the early opt-in to MA. Assuming that works that way, and you said you're not sure yet, and you'll get back to us on that, but assuming that it does work that way, in that scenario, will there be some counties that disproportionately benefit and those that don't? Will there, for lack of a better word, will there be winners and losers in that, or do you expect that distribution would be equally? In other words, an equal percentage of Anoka County would be participating in the early opt-in and an equal percentage of Hennepin County, for example. Is my question clear?
Ms. O'Connell.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nino, you're now reaching a level of detail that I can't provide you the specifics. You know, the way that the, you know, we know a great deal about who was in the GMC program and who will be the primary beneficiaries of the expansion of medical assistance. And so, you know, we will be looking at that, you know, roughly the breakdown. Well, I shouldn't even guess. I think I should tell you that we will get back to you with that. But again, you know, people will be enrolling in the medical assistance, and I know there will be significant efforts on the part of community organizations to get people enrolled in the MA opt-in. So, you know, I think it just depends where that 100,000 currently are.
Ms. O'Connell, just before we continue, just the text in your handout here talks about that currently this is a program for people who are not enrolled in medical assistance. Could you just clarify for the committee who are those people? Who are we talking about here as this is currently structured?
The current proposal.
Ms. O'Connell, it says that the this is a recommendation for a chemical dependency treatment cost. It's a program for clients who are not enrolled in medical assistance. And so the question is, are they not enrolled because they're not eligible, or who are we talking about here? Who is the group of clients we're talking about?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe that this would be the people that are uninsured, underinsured, and, you know, that lost coverage when GMC was eliminated. Those are the people that that the county would be paying for.
But
you know, to be on medical assistance, you have to meet a category of eligibility. So,
And Ms. O'Connell, that's kind of my question. Are these people who are not enrolled in medical assistance because they just haven't enrolled, in which case maybe we should try to enroll them, I suppose, or are they not enrolled because they don't qualify for medical assistance? That's what I'm trying to understand.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this population, you know, would be the group that does not, that is not eligible for medical assistance because they are not disabled enough to meet that category of eligibility, or they were a single adult or childless couple. You know, prior to March 1st, if you were a single adult or childless couple, you were not eligible for medical assistance unless you were found disabled. So it's that, it's the old GMC population that we're now converting to medical assistance, and then the underinsured and uninsured.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, I just want people to remember one thing. When the GMC program was changed, the chemical dependency benefit was removed from the benefit set with the idea that the consolidated fund would serve all of those people's needs that previously had been served through the GMC program. So that was a pretty big shift to the counties at that time, because they did have at that time the 16.4% share that they had to pay for all of those people that were in the fund because of that hadn't been in the fund previously.
Thank you. And Ms. O'Connell, before we proceed, you're talking about a roughly $5 million reduction in each of the years of the biennium. What is the total amount of money that we are spending in this program at the state level? This is, I assume, is not an elimination of the funding. It is just a reduction. But what is the total amount that we spend, of which this $5 million is being reduced on an annual basis?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe the total is $102 million.
So just to be clear, Ms. O'Connell, the $102 million is, the, again, the forecasted amount that we're looking at. which I assume is more than the current amount that we're spending in this biennium, and we're proposing a $5 million per year reduction from $102 million in the forecast.
Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct.
Thank you. I don't see any other questions right now, so continue.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, turning to page 96, this is the governor's proposal to reduce state-operated services, mental health services, and I'm going to call my A-team to the table right away on this, and I'm going to turn the explanation for this budget page over to Mike Tesner, who is the head of state-operated services.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mike Tesner. I'm Chief Executive Officer for State Operated Services, Minnesota Department of Human Services. The proposal in front of you is reducing the subacute services out of the Wilmer area for State Operated Services. If you recall, last year our budget proposal moved that from a hospital level of care to a subacute level of care. This proposal removes the service altogether in that region. It saves, I believe, approximately the 5.2 over the biennium. It impacts 26 employees, about 17 or 18 FTEs. We believe that this level of care is an important addition to the way that we provide services, because what this allows us to do is, if individuals need less than hospital level of care and are coming to us to care, then we have that capacity in our system. And if they're in a hospital and no longer meet the acute level of care need in a hospital, we have a place to discharge or transfer that person to. We do have a capacity out of the Wadena site that is currently available, and we believe that that capacity will serve us across the state. The downside to this has to do with the geography, because obviously having a site in Wilmer best serves geographically that region, and Wadena is kind of a long way away. However, we believe we can still provide this level of care, which we believe is necessary within the array of services state-operated services has.
Thank you, Mr. Tesner. We had made a request in the presentation of the changes that presenters would come and talk about the current level of funding in the current biennium, the forecasted amount, and then the change as it relates to both of those items. I find I'm continuing to ask for that. Could you tell us what those numbers are, what this represents as a total, as a reduction, 5.3 million reduction to what?
Mr. Chair, the current adult mental health appropriation that we're operating under for this year is $120 million.
I'm sorry,
$120 million. So that would be $240 for the biennium. And this represents 5.2, I believe, reduction.
Mr. Tesner, just to be clear, is that the forecasted amount or is that the current biennium amount?
Mr. Chair, we don't operate under a forecast for our program. It is our base is at the $120 million figure.
So, Mr. Tesner, the current biennium base is $240 million for this program, and that is also the forecasted amount for the 2012-13 budget period, and you're proposing to reduce that by $5 million.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Thank you. Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, I have three questions. The first one is, so how many beds are being affected in Wilmer by this closure? How many empty beds are there in the system statewide in the CBHHs? And have you considered moving the children's program at Wilmer to a place that would be closer to the families that are served by that program? Most of those children come from the metro area, I believe.
Mr. Tesner.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, the current program, I think I got your questions down. The current size of the program is 16 beds. It's running about 50% occupancy. The Wadena program, which is our other subacute unit, is running about 50% occupancy, which is why we believe that this will still have capacity in our system to serve this the subacute level. The CBHH utilization is running on average daily census of 10 to 12, which is about 70 to 80% occupancy. The seven CBHHs we're currently operating. And in terms of the last question of have we considered moving the CABS program to the Twin Cities, we have we've certainly entertained that idea. That's not what the current proposal calls for. The current proposal ensures that we're still utilizing the physical space that the current subacute unit's in, allows us to live up to our obligations with the lease. It also allows us to leave the what was the old Wilmer campus, now owned by the county and a private entity. Part of the agreement in the sale of that campus was that we would eventually vacate, so this is allowing us to vacate to, frankly, space that's, that best serves, better serves the population that we're now serving. We are mindful that about 60 to 70% of the folks that are admitted to the hospital, the CABS hospital, are from the Twin Cities, and that the geography is problematic for those families.
Senator Berglund, do you have a question to follow up?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Tesner, in the future when your lease would expire, would there be savings in moving that program to other space that you might have available in the metro area?
Mr. Tesson.
Mr.
Tesson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, that's an interesting question. Haven't thought that far ahead. We still have, I think, 10 years on the lease. Certainly, if we have space in the Twin Cities, for example, out of the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center, which is a hospital and is specifically designed to serve a hospital level of care, which does not have a lease requirement, there would potentially be a savings in such a move.
Senator Newman, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Esner, I'll ask Senator Berglund's question just a little bit differently. Within the $120 million program that we're talking about, how many folks are served at the Wilmer facility? How many folks are served within the program throughout the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Tesner.
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, I have to sort this in my head. The current Wilmer program's average daily census has been running about 8, with an average length of stay somewhere around 90 days, which means, let me do the math, 8 times 4. I'm sorry, but I can't do the math in my head. I can get you those utilization figures because we have them for all of our programs, and specifically the adult mental health, which is what we're talking about. I just don't have those in front of me today. But the average daily census is a pretty good indicator. So 50% occupancy, 8 beds filled, average length of a treatment stay is about 90 days, which means each bed turns over 4 times a year. Times 8 is, I'm not doing the math in my head well enough. Yeah, but that's wrong.
I'm not trying to put you on the spot. My math fails me too. If you could get me the numbers on that at a later date, that's fine with me.
Thank you. And Sarah Lloyd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a totally different topic. If we're not done with that one, we can finish up. But to your question about the base amounts and the forecasted amounts and things, there is really helpful information in the background sections in the back of these books, but there's no table of contents for it.
Right.
And so I'm struggling trying to, you know, it's really helpful to flip back there and find out some of this context. If, you know, so this is a DHS, you know, overview. A table of contents for the background information would be incredibly helpful so that we can find this background. And then the forecast amounts and the 10 and 11 biennium is in there, and some more history about. So for state-operated services, just so people know, it begins at page 145 and goes on for 10 pages and is really helpful background that members should flip to. And take a look at.
Senator Lurie, and I appreciate you pointing that out. I also have been struggling with that, and we did make the request to the department when they presented to at least provide us with a page reference so we could do that. And it's apparently we need to make that request again, but that would be helpful for us if you could tell us not only what you're changing, but give us at least the page reference so we can go back and look at what the current budget is and what the forecast is so that we can see the magnitude of the change. You know, in my world, $5 million is a lot of money, but you're talking about $240 million. Maybe that's proportionally not as big as what you might think otherwise. So that would be helpful going forward. Senator Higgins.
And, Mr. Chair, for years I have been asking for budget pages to actually tell us the amount of money that we're subtracting from. And I don't know why we can't manage to get that in our budget pages. It doesn't seem to matter who the governor is. It's been, I mean, this is my fourth governor, and it's always been that way. And but, man, it would be so much more useful to us if we could start with that piece on these budget pages.
Senator Higgins, I couldn't agree more, and I think you're right. It's not a issue with whoever the governor is. I think it's just the way that we do budgets, and I think it, in my opinion, adds to the complexity and the confusion that we wrestle with. My background in business, we talk about budgets all the time. You always see what you spent, what you're proposing to spend, what you're proposing to change, all right in front of you. It helps the discussion, and I just would encourage you as we go forward here to help us see that more clearly. I appreciate it. And I guess without any other questions, please continue.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, so I will be providing the breakdown of annual service by each individual service for Adult Mental Health Services, which will give you a sense of how many people by site that we serve.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, then if there are no other questions, I'll turn to the final budget proposal, which is located on page 97. And this is the governor's proposal to extend coverage for tribal child placements. And this proposal is budget neutral. And I'll turn it over to Mr. Vern LaPlante to explain it.
Good morning, everybody. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Vern LaPlante. I'm Tribal Relations Officer for the Department of Human Services. You have before you a proposal that does two things. One, it adds tribes to a list of vendors that will be eligible to be reimbursed for children's mental health services. And the second piece that's important is will allow the state to reimburse at the federally negotiated encounter rate, which will also allow 100% federal participation. So the goal here is to increase access for American Indians placed through tribal facilities into children's mental health services so that they receive the services, but also that allowing to tap into the 100% federal funding that tribes can use to cover those services. Currently, the tribes have a most of the tribes have a mental health infrastructure in place that where they have their mental health professionals that do the diagnosis and make determination of what the appropriate level of care is for the children. And this will facilitate the placement of those children into a children's residential facility when that diagnosis finds that that's appropriate. But like I said, the important thing is also tapping into the 100% federal financing. Last year we came before you and we actually succeeded in getting some legislation passed. We found out that we didn't go deep enough. This clarifies and will make this help us to implement what we tried to do last year, and that is to improve access. If anybody has any questions, I can answer those.
Your questions. Thank you. Thank you for your comments. And Ms. O'Connell, I assume this is the end of your portion of the presentation.
Yes.
And I want to thank you for being here and coming back, and I appreciate you're relatively new to the job, as many of us are, so we appreciate your willingness to help us sort through this.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we will be following up on the data that you've requested and our you know, willing to meet with any of you to address your specific concerns, too. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, we're going to proceed to the next portion of the budget that we want to cover is the sex offender program, and welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Dan Storkamp, the Deputy Director of the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. I'm going to be covering the change page on 98, the MSOP growth page. But in addition, Mr. Chair and members, I do have a handout that I'm going to cover after that that it gives you the totality of our budget over the last several bienniums, as well as our population numbers that I know the committee has requested. So if Paige could help us pass that out, I think that's what the committee has been looking for. Mr. Chair and members, first of all, I want to thank you for allowing us to present last week on the MSOP program and giving you an overview. During that presentation, I think you heard about the increased growth of the population, the admissions coming in from the courts. And as you can see on page 98, the chart actually shows the projected growth. We're seeing an increase of 54 more clients in fiscal year 12 and another 52 on top of that in 13. This is based on current laws, current trends, and current practices, and we're anticipating the 106 over this next biennium. So really, the change request before you is based on that item, the 106 more clients coming in, as well as what we anticipate the cost is, or the marginal per diem, for those individuals. So it's only the cost for those coming online, and that's $144 a day. And again, it's only a cost associated with those new clients. What this does for our change request is the $2.8 million the first half the biennium and another $5.8 million the second half. Just so the committee understands, per statute, counties pay 10% of that cost. So 10% will be coming back into the general revenues, and that's noted on the page as well in the budget book. Overall, I think our base budget of fiscal year 11 was $67.4 million, and as soon as the chart's handed out, I will walk through that as well.
I think we're getting that distributed okay. Here.
Mr. Chair and members, the chart that's being handed out really shows a lot of information on one chart, but I wanted to give a full picture of the Minnesota Sex Offender Program historically as well as moving forward. What you're going to see on the chart are several things. I'm going to start with the green line that starts in fiscal year 2006 and moves to fiscal year 13. These are the number of clients that we have or anticipate to have per projections at the end of that biennium. So you can see the annual growth looking across the years. The bars actually show our appropriated budget. So in fiscal year 06, it was 43 up to 75 in 08. You'll see that we did have our decrease between 08 and 010 in funding. That was a program adjustment where we reduced positions as well as made significant changes to both security as well as treatment to the program, as well as some process improvement enhancements to gain that base funding. What you've seen in 2011, 12, and 13, the budget is actually anticipated with the growth of the population. And again, it is only for those additional things. Mr. Chair, as you've been asking about the bienniums, we put that on the top of each of the areas. So in fiscal year 6 and 7, we had $105 million with 386 clients. In fiscal year 8 or 9, it was $146 million with 521 clients. Fiscal year 10 and 11 was $132 million with 629 clients. Note that the legislature and the governor last year for fiscal year 10 appropriated $26.5 million in federal stimulus funding for that year, which was a one-time funding mechanism. In fiscal year 12 and 13, we're anticipating $143 million with 735 clients. Again, that's an increase of 106 clients.
So this was a total of.
Thank you. And I appreciate the contextual information as well. We appreciate that. Just a question on this, and I know there was a story recently written in one of the papers about this program and essentially the costs associated with it, and apparently there have been thoughts in the past that there may be some things that we should contemplate doing that could be a departure perhaps from the current structure, but one that might be more fiscally sustainable or more efficient. Has there been any thoughts or proposals that the department is entertaining to to look at the structure of what we're doing, and with the view of trying to maybe do something that would not be you're showing quite a growth curve here, and I think we all acknowledge this is a fairly costly program, and just any thoughts you might have on that.
Mr. Chair, members, again, I'm Janine Hebert. I'm the Executive Clinical Director. I'll just try and assist Dan a little bit in this discussion. He's the numbers person. I'll do the big picture work. The cost and growth of MSOP has been an issue. And from our earlier presentation, when I talked about the pie of civil commitment, MSOP's piece to that pie is, of course, treatment. And there's other opportunities there to intervene on the larger process. The obviously, folks coming in the door, if we had less people coming in, our costs would go down, and if we had more people leaving, costs could go down. So ideas and suggestions and conversations have occurred over time with taking a look at the civil commitment process, increasing efficiencies while they're in treatment, and then taking a look at folks on their way out the door. So there was a report to the legislature that was done. There's also the Office of Legislative Auditors report, which is due, our understanding is due to come out days, not weeks necessarily, that has some recommendations on it. MSOP is committed to working with groups or offering suggestions to the degree our expertise could be helpful. But it's a big picture, comprehensive issue. And keeping in mind, as Mr. Storkamp commented, current statutes, current trends and practices, if we adjust any of those, it will take time for that to play out. So there's not, unfortunately, immediate fixes or short-term fixes that we can see other than doing efficiencies and continuing in the process that we've already engaged in. So I don't know that that answers the question. But we'll continue to participate in the dialogue. We're not here for job security. It would be nice to keep this program for folks that it's designed for and to assist those when they're treated to go back in the community where we anticipate they'll be treated at a less expensive rate.
Senator Berglund.
The people that you provide treatment to that are in prison, is that number constant or is that number changing at all?
Saber.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, members, the program Senator Berglund speaking of is our 50-bed program that we work in collaboration with the Department of Corrections in the prison up at Moose Lake. And that 50-bed program is constantly full, yes. There's a waiting list for that program. And those folks engage in treatment provided by MSOP clinicians at a rate of being incarcerated, so they're treated as though they're inmates or offenders in prison. But it is full.
Senator Berglund.
But, Mr. Chairman, there is a limit on that expenditure based on a number of beds. Is that correct?
Ms. Haber.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, if I understand that correctly, yes, it's a 50-bed program, and that's the limit currently of what we operate in. We share that cost with corrections 50-50.
And Mr. Senator Berglund. Chairman, the increase in per diem that you're requesting, Will it apply to that program as well?
Mr. Storkamp.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, no. This is strictly for the Minnesota Sex Offender Program and our current costs.
Mr. Senator Chairman Berglund. And Mr. Storkamp, but you have the same staff providing the treatment, so are you covering those increased costs through this request rather than sharing those increased costs?
Mr. Storkin.
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, at this point, what is in the budget is what the legislature passed last year, which was half the cost was covered by the MSOP program, which is in our budget, and half is not, which was covered by the Department of Corrections budget. And that's the budget that we are bringing forward again this year. So we aren't covering the additional cost of that other half at this point. In this request.
Right.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Storkamp, I understand how it's supposed to get paid for, but there would be a marginal increase for those 50 beds for your half of the increase per diem. Is that correct?
Mr. Storkamp.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, the marginal increase, or Mr. Chair, I'm bringing the expert to the table.
All right, very good. Please identify yourself.
I'm Peter Maurer. I'm the Financial Services Director for the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. Mr. Chair, Senator, The staffing level at the DOC program, as I understand, will not change because we're operating at full capacity. Therefore, there are no increased costs for that part of the program in our marginal per diem because that's a different site. We would only include those costs if we were going to increase treatment, increase the number of offenders there, and we aren't. So that is not part of the marginal per diem calculation, nor is it part of our change level request.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to ask this question a little bit differently then. Is the increase that you're requesting only for an increase in the number of the population that you expect to be committed by the courts, and is there no increase based on increased personnel costs that would be projected over the next 2 years? Health care, pensions, salaries.
Mr. Maurer, Mr. Storkamp.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the per diem, the marginal per diem included in the calculation are increased staff, which we would have to hire at the St. Peter and Moose Lake sites as new clients come in. The costs we've calculated do not include inflation. They're based on the salary plan as of January 2010. It does include fringes. But again, it's only staff which we would physically locate at our Moose Lake facility or at our St. Peter, not at the prison. So the formula we used is the clinicians have said for every, say, for every so many clients, for 50 clients, we need three more clinicians. In this would be a calculation at the midpoint salary level for each position. We need three clinicians. We'll put them at Moose Lake. I'm not sure that answers your question, but we've included fringes, retirement, FICA, salary in our calculations based on the number of staff we think we would have to hire over the next biennium.
And based on current rates, not projecting increases.
Everything is based on current rates. There is no inflation built in any of the amounts we used for the change level request.
Thank you.
And I have Senator Higgins, I think, had a question, and then Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To any of the testifiers, I'm looking at page 98 of the handout, and it appears we've got a statute that requires that we provide treatment to these folks. We are looking at 735 individuals that we're going to spend $144 million on in the next biennium. And one of the key goals and measures of your program is responsiveness to treatment. Give me some idea of whether or not this is the same question that I was asking from the previous programs. Give me some idea in language that I can understand, please, that as to whether or not this is money well spent in accordance with our statutory directive. Are we being successful? Are there individuals that are being released back into society that are not reoccurring offenders?
Ms. Haber, did you want to take a crack at that?
Mr. Chair, Senator, a couple pieces, and if I don't hit all of that, I can give it another shot. As a reminder from our presentation before, MSOP has not successfully released a client into the community, so we don't have any track record of folks in the community yet. That said, treatment is a process, and the change is a process that occurs. It doesn't happen suddenly at the door of our community preparation services upon provisional discharge. So our measurement of engagement in treatment is based on those who participate in treatment. Of course, we try to motivate individuals to engage in change process. We look for dynamic changes in individuals while they are housed with us. So are they maintaining the rules of the program? Are they not assaulting each other or our staff? Are there other instances that we would expect treatment participants to be engaged, not in that behavior, once they're participating in treatment? So I think that the success of treatment is an ongoing dynamic measure, not just an individual out into the community. So to say that just because the courts have not released anyone from our program, to imply that treatment isn't happening, I think is a little naive in that there's 605 folk that we have. 80% of them are engaged in treatment on a daily basis, and they're making changes incrementally along the way, hopefully maintaining that change so they are prepared for a successful release and provisional discharge.
Senator Newman.
Thank you. Perhaps I am naive in this area. I don't know. Give me an idea. How long is this treatment program's been going on. It obviously predates 2006. How old is this program?
Ms. Haber.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the psychopathic personality law in Minnesota has been on the books since 1939, and that has morphed over the years. So the Minnesota Sex Offender Program has been around for decades. 2003 saw a significant increase in our referrals. Civil commitment programs in general, other programs across the country, the other 19 in the states and one in the Fed system, estimates 8 to 9 years of programming before they consider releases. Now, I don't know that that's exactly apples to apples. But I think that that puts us into the group of similar types of programming. So if you imagine that we got the referrals in 2003, a year to 18 months in the court process to get someone civilly committed, this is the bubble of folks who have chosen to participate, and if they're doing it successfully, are starting to creep towards the end of the treatment program.
Senator Newman.
If we use 2003 then as sort of a starting point, is it your testimony that since 2003 we have been spending hundreds of millions of dollars on a very small group of individuals and have yet to have successfully completed treatment so we can release them into society? Is that what I am hearing?
Yeah. Ms. Haber. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the short answer is yes.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Other questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Nino.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I heard you correctly, you said there's kind of this 8 to 9, I'll just round it off and say about a 10-year time frame to where we might be seeing success. In your estimation, and I understand, like me, your crystal ball is probably broken. In your estimation, in the next couple of years, can we anticipate seeing some successful releases?
Ms. Haber.
Mr. Chair, Senator, members, again, as a reminder, MSOP doesn't decide who gets to be released and that it's the courts that makes that decision. Individuals need to petition to the courts to do that. That said, we have 7 clients currently residing outside the secured perimeter in community preparation services down in St. Peter. So those are the ones who would be knocking on the provisional discharge door. The step before that, we have 30 clients in the transitions program in St. Peter who are also in the later stages of treatment. So there's movement and there's progress. That said, there are some clients that will never participate in treatment. There's some clients that I don't anticipate will ever leave MSOP for a variety of reasons. So I don't think that 10 years from now all 600 folk will be out living in the community. But we do have clients who have progressed to the ends of treatment, and courts will be considering their petitions in the coming months and years.
Senator Nino.
Thank you. That's helpful. And I understand that I'm asking you to kind of project out. But just looking at the mix that you have right now and those that you kind of anticipate maybe are on that track, because it's hard for me looking at these numbers as they've gone over the year to get kind of any base of what was there. What kind of, if you consider them a class, if you will, you know, the class of 2004, I mean, what percentage are we looking at potentially being successful in completion, and what percentage is not?
Ms. Haber.
Potentially. I understand. This is all theoretical.
Mr. Chair, Senator, my broken crystal ball.
Yeah.
I think the best way to respond to that is to think of, again, comparing ourselves to other civil commitment programs. There are several civil commitment programs. The majority have never released anybody. Wisconsin is a well-known program. It's a reputable program. They release now about 10 a year out of their program. So even a well-run program that has increased efficiencies and I think does excellent treatment and hasn't gone through some of the changes in statutes, they will trickle out of the program. If I could say that I am confident that folks who are currently in our transitions program in St. Peter, that's 30 individuals, there's probably another 10 in our alternative program who are in our phase 3 of treatment, plus the 7 living outside the secure perimeter. If they continue at the rate that they're going in treatment, and folks have setbacks and I can't make promises, those folks will go before the courts in the next year or so. And there are people who are progressing through programming up at Moose Lake. So I just don't know the specific number and percentage. We have an 80% participation rate in treatment, so that tells you there's 20% of that 600 that aren't doing treatment today. I would also just add briefly, I think that we will have a different pace of movement through treatment once there is a provisional discharge. You can imagine that individuals will choose to not participate in treatment if there's no light at the end of that tunnel. And we anticipate the courts hearing provisional discharges this year. That may accelerate the progress of other clients in treatment. So I would see that as a positive influence.
So Ms. Aber, just to be clear, people who are in this program who choose not to participate in any of the treatment, they are never going to be eligible for going to before a court to seek release. Is that essentially correct?
Mr. Chair, members, individuals can petition for release at any time, and they will be considered by the Special Review Board and the courts. So they have the right as civilly committed individuals to petition. They would not have the support, likely, from MSOP, but ultimately it's the Special Review Board and the courts that would decide.
Senator Sharon, and then
I just would ask you to, as we think about this in terms of this trajectory of the costs out of the Health and Human Services budget, that the courts really control because they're the ones that are making the decisions on both ends, coming in and going out. This eats up more and more of the Health and Human Services budget and crowds out other areas, which is why we've asked for the study and for some suggestions about civil commitment changes and stuff like that. But when we're talking about successful treatment, we're talking about a risk analysis. You're trying to measure risk as a part of this process in terms of real fence. And when you're presenting in front of the courts, that's what they're asking about. Is that correct? First of all, I'm making that assumption that's correct. And can you speak to what level of risk the public and the courts are willing to take on when that request comes in front of them?
Ms. Haber.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'll again take a shot at it. In considering risk with sex offenders, it is based predominantly on what we call actuarial tools. And actuarial tools, not unlike if you have car insurance, are based on putting risk on people who are members of a group. So an 18-year-old male, unfortunately, driving a Corvette would be a higher risk, but that doesn't say what his individual risk is. It goes to the actuarial group. So that model is similar with sex offenders, in that the tools that they use to measure risk, which you'll hear at a forensic evaluator's testimony before the court, will put an individual in a group of offenders. So we don't have the science yet to have the crystal ball to know about individual risk. That said, there are static and dynamic factors. Those actuarial tools are built on static factors. Those aren't going to change. The number of victims that they've had, the gender of their victims, their own gender, pieces like that go into the actuarial tools. So if you just look at an actuarial measure, they may come into the program with a score on the static 99, which is a tool of a 6, and they may leave the program treated with a score of a 6 on the static because it measures static factors. Dynamic factors are what we intervene on in treatment. So when we think of someone who is at the end of treatment, we would support someone who has made changes on dynamic factors, their attitudes, their behaviors, their sexual deviancy, their arousal patterns, their cooperation with rules and supervision. Those can change. That's what we measure when we think about risk. So the courts determine risk based on static factors, which tend to not change, dynamic factors, which is what we testify before, and then case file of who this individual is. So in a long route, individuals who complete treatment in MSOP will have been able to demonstrate that they can manage their dynamic risk factors. So they're going to look pretty good on dynamic scales. Their static scales are still going to be high because these are the highest risk sex offenders, and that's how the courts place them to us. So we would testify that someone has completed treatment. They have perhaps successfully managed their dynamic risk factors to our ability to know that they in an artificial environment like our institution, and we will follow them into the community and watch these dynamic risk factors as they go. To think that they will be at zero risk, I think is unreasonable. Will they always have high scores on their static factors? They will, because they did heinous, horrible crimes. And that's what measures static factors. So they're complicated discussions that happen before the bench, particularly with sex offenders, with where the research and science is right now. Those are the pieces that they would take into play: completion of treatment, static factors, and dynamic factors.
And just to follow up, my point, though, is that the decision there is in the court, and there is something that we have to understand here is the public's and reflected in the court's decision-making about what comfort level they have with the risk that you're laying in front of them. And it depends a little bit on the appetite, or as you have indicated, where you had this big increase, if there's a public event that's happened that's a sex offense, it can take away the governor or the release board's appetite for releasing people from this system. That's why the report and the redactions were so important to this committee, that they not be made, because they're going to talk about things that prevent the process or restrict the recidivism or at least restrict the entry into the system in the first place.
Thank you. And Senator Berglund and then Senator Rosen.
Mr. Chairman, I think one other factor, however, that it's important for people to remember is when someone is released from this program, it's not even like they're being released from prison with a probation officer, da-da-da. They will have very, very close scrutiny and monitoring. And so those will be costs that we will have for those individuals, even though they have been released. And do you have an idea of what you anticipate those costs per person will be?
Mr. Storkamp? Ms. Aber?
I'll take a piece of that, and then Mr. Storkamp can do the money part. Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, we have a... In anticipation of the courts making a determination for provisional discharge, we have plans for reintegration. We have staff already on board who are reintegration specialists who will be providing the supervision of individuals when they're on provisional discharge. So I don't anticipate another personnel cost in that area. We already have those folks on board. As far as housing and needs for that client, that comes out of MSOP's budget, and we have a reintegration budget. But again, we have no one in that state of treatment to have a track record with regard to that. I would also say that that's with regard to Senator Sharon's comment about tolerance of risk, in essence, is that these folks need supervision and treatment in the community. And that's an investment that I think is driven by public safety as well as treatment need. But I don't anticipate costs in reintegration with regard to personnel, but Mr. Storkamp may respond.
Mr. Storkamp.
Senator Berglund, the reintegration component does have a small budget today, but as Janine talks about, we've got no track record here to identify what that cost ultimately be, especially when somebody's provisionally discharged. So we're going to have to monitor that here over the next year or two to see how many provisional discharges we have, what the costs are associated with that. So there will be a cost to that, but we don't have the figure factored in at this point.
Thank you. Senator Rosen and then Senator Higgins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the to you folks up there, has anybody ever had you break down your costs for us for this this has been in front of this division. Sometimes it goes over to public safety back and forth. But I'd be very, very interested in knowing. I know it's $144 per day per patient. And you have about 683 patients there. So I'm coming up with about $36 million. And the reason I ask this, I'm going to just be blunt because we're running out of time. There has been some grave concerns about the middle management posts that have been in place in St. Peter, to be exact, where staff has been cut to save some of this administrative cost. And so I would personally like to ask you to give us a rundown on where the funds are going, where this is all spent, because I'd like to get that cleared up. And I think administrative cost in this whole budget, Health and Human Services budget, needs to be looked at. Mr. Chair.
Mr. Storkamp, is that something you can provide us at some point?
Mr. Chair and members, yes. So I will provide it both the overall per diem as well as the marginal per diem of $144.
Thank you. Senator Higgins?
Mr. Chair, when we come back tomorrow, are we going to start back on this item? If so, I can hold my question.
Well, Senator Higgins, we'll not be here tomorrow, but we'll be Friday morning.
We're not here tomorrow?
I don't believe we meet on Thursday.
Okay. Okay, well, then I'll forget it between now and then. So maybe it'll be a short question. The cost of the treatment and supervision in the community, will that continue to be part of MSOP's budget, like forever and ever, amen?
Mr. Storkamp or Ms. Aber?
Mr. Chair, Aber? Senator Higgins, yes, MSOP, to the degree that we would provide the supervision and treatment, we would factor that into our budget. It would continue to be paid out as the per diem, so the county would pay 10% of that, as though they're still under provisional discharge, so they're still under the civil commitment umbrella, so they're still our client.
Okay. And then my last question is, are there going to be any restrictions on where these clients will live when they are discharged out to the community?
Ms. Aber.
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, it would follow their individual risk, obviously. So we would have individual provisional discharge plans based on the needs of that client. So, of course, we would be able to monitor and limit based on the need of that client and the safety of the community and also where they're at in treatment.
Mr. Chair, considering they're the worst sex offenders that we have, it would be very likely it would be very strongly supervised and limited in where they could live. Because, Mr. Chair, I know some communities, the one I live in, for example, we are seriously overrepresented in the level 3, well, every other level, too, sex offenders who come back to the community because they get to choose, they have to find their own housing and choose where they're going to live. And I don't want these clients to be put in that same situation where they go right back home where they got into trouble, where it's likely that their victims have been and all of those types of issues that would come into play.
Thank you. And members, if there are further questions for the sex offender treatment program, I would prefer that we take a few minutes, even though we're a little bit over time, to continue the discussion. If there are no further questions, then I guess we can contemplate adjournment, and on Fridays when we'll reconvene at 9:30, and we're going to start to talk about the continuing care administration and the health care administration, if we get that far. And given our track record, we'll see. But I appreciate the questions and comments from members of the committee and appreciate your coming today. Thank you, and we are adjourned.
When is the budget?